Okay, we got it queued up here. And so we go in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin. Gosh, that music sounds
Hey, that
familiar.
theme song sounds familiar. Sounds very familiar to me. I love this opening.
Oh yes, this film collection here opening has always
Yeah,
been my favorite.
definitely. Written by Eddie Foreman and produced by Alex Gottlieb. Now, this is only for the first 5 episodes, I believe. And then they left, and Gene Yarbrough took over as producer and director for the rest of the series. And this is the Joe Besser, yay! Alvia Allman, who was played Mrs. Niles on their radio show for 7 years, and also worked on their ABC show as well.
I have to say, I've always preferred first season over second season because of
Yes.
this setup. The whole concept of we're doing a show and let's set it up and then we'll bring the audience in.
Yes, exactly. And it gives it kind of that live feeling, you know? But there's one thing I wanted to discuss while we're here with the Bud and Lou show. The laugh track. Now, it's legend that Abbott and Costello, well, Lou owned the show. It was Lou's show. And Bud was on salary. So he didn't make the decisions here. So it was Lou and Gene Yarbrough and whatever. Pat Costello was also a producer. But whatchamacallit, they say that they took the finished film and showed it to a theater full of people and recorded the response. And then, sweetened it as it needed it along the way. I don't believe it. I'm sorry. It just seems too unbelievable for me. Lou was a very cost-conscious producer. He did not like to spend a lot of money. And when he did overspend on this show, which he did, he had to cut back on the second season, which is obvious because the second season is bare bones, no music. Very, very, the quality of the film stock is not as good. And whatever. So I don't know. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think number one, there would be photographs, taken and maybe, of the audiences or Bud and Lou, maybe at the theater. It just sounds like too much effort for something that was already a typical thing. The laugh track was already a typical, easy thing to do. So I don't know. I just think it's a laugh track.
It's just got that sound to it. I mean, if you sweeten an actual live audience, it will sound a little more artificial, but this just sounds straight artificial. It's a laugh track.
Yeah, and not only that, the timing of the laughs, they often cut into the dialogue or it starts before the punchline. It's just weirdly timed, and I never liked it. And it's why I prefer the live show to their film show. And the film show is great. I mean, they're doing their routines. It's just straight Abbott and Costello. And here's Sid Fields doing what he did best. This is what his routine that he did for years in burlesque, and then Abbott and Costello. But Sid Fields was a burlesque performer, and he was hired by Eddie Cantor in the early 30s or mid 30s to write on his radio show and appear as a character called Mr. Guffey, where he did basically what he's doing right now with Eddie Cantor. I mean, he's doing right now with Lou Costello, but he would do it with Eddie Cantor on the radio. And eventually he joined the Abbott and Costello writing staff of their radio show and also appeared again doing this kind of thing. He appeared in a few of their movies doing the same bit. And eventually he ended up, after Lou died, actually, Lou hired him to play straight in Lou's last show in Las Vegas. But then after Lou died, Jackie Gleason, who was a good friend of Lou's, picked up Sid Fields and hired him for his TV show. And Sid would come out and do this exact same thing with Jackie. Mm-hmm. So, whatchamacallit? So Sid plied his trade through all of those decades. He ended up in Las Vegas, living in Las Vegas, where he had his own column in a local paper. It was like a gossip column where he talked about what was going on in Las Vegas, about his history and all that stuff. I would love to get a collection of his stuff, you know, that he wrote for the paper, but I have no idea what paper it was.
Yeah.
So, and he passed away in the mid-1970s. But boy, was he a trooper, and did he add to this show. It was almost like he was the third member of the team. You
yes.
know? And look at him. And where's Bud? Bud's like in a sauna, you know. Yeah. Drinking a mint julep while he's having a foot massage. And poor Lou is killing himself. Oh, I love this routine. I just love this routine.
Mm-hmm.
Yay! What do you think? Ice cream? Sour cream? What is that?
Who knows what it actually was?
Bud's out looking for his mustache.
Yeah.
Oh, there he is. I always thought that was interesting. Their little kitchenette. You know, yeah. It's such a small, shoddy apartment. And look at that. It's got the one shelf. It's got the little oven, the sink. There's Bud in a nutshell.
Yep.
If I can help you, I won't. There we go. Look at that. And there's a fly swatter. What is that? What's the opening?
Sir.
Oh, oil.
He's making fudge.
Oh, look at that. Oh, this one used to kill me, Jerry. It just used to kill me. It's glue. He got glue. That's glue Costello.
Yeah.
Stick to it, Lou. This is like Here Come the Coeds, the kitchen scene.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine being poor Lou and you have to rely on Bud Abbott for help?
Yeah.
This is just like Here Come the Coeds. You can't do a thing right. Certainly. So this show, each season was 26 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou blew it. I have to say, he was not the businessman. He kept waiting for a better deal, you know? He was offered a deal, I think it was by CBS, and that would have been great because it would have been a network show. And, you know, he just waited. Well, maybe there'll be a better deal, maybe a better deal. And finally, he took a syndication deal, which a few people were doing around this time. Eddie Cantor, for one, switched his show over to syndication. But in doing so, they hurt themselves. Number one, it turns out the money was not as good for Lou. He blew it. You know, he waited too long. And secondly, it's sold to markets separately. It's a product sold separately. There's Elvira Allman. She was the Mrs. Niles on their radio show. And you always see her on Petticoat Junction and Andy Griffith and all those shows. She was wonderful. But what was I saying before that?
The syndication.
Yes. The show was sold to about 40 stations around the country. But it meant that there was no rhyme or reason. One city would start with this episode. Another city would start with a different episode. It was never in order. It was just very willy-nilly. And Lou should have taken the network deal. He would have died a very, very rich man.
Yeah.
But now this is syndication. And there's my buddy Mike the Cop. I love this. This used to make me laugh. A real police whistle. It doesn't work. You'll have a lot of fun with it. This is Gordon Winivo, W-Y-N-N-I-V-O. That was his middle name. Winivo Jones, Gordon Jones, born in 1911 in Alden, Iowa. He was a member of John Wayne's stock company. He's in a lot of John Wayne movies. John really liked him, and Lou liked him a lot. First used him in Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap as the villain, Jake Frame. And he's also in The Secret Life of Walter Mitty with Danny Kaye. Yeah. And he's sort of Danny Kaye's nemesis. And I always root for Gordon Jones.
Yeah.
and he was the original Green Hornet in the movie serials. And he was also a leading man in B-movies in the late 1930s, early 40s. He died of a heart attack at the age of 52 in 1963. Same age as Lou. Look at this. This is it. This is my favorite part of the show. And look at how he's dressed. That top hat. Oh, Mr. Fields. This is so dirty. It's filthy. That picture. I just love the fact that that's what he wanted to give him as a picture of him in an 1890s bathing suit, smoking a cigar in a bathtub. Mm-hmm. I know that's on my list. Oh, and speaking of beautiful tall women.
Oh, yes.
There's Hillary. Beautiful Hillary. Yay! The comic book. Terry and the used car dealers. At least the villains were, you know, real villains. Okay, so he's putting together the antipasto hors d'oeuvres. And of course, instead of the antipasto, he puts something that sounds like antipasto. And we're talking about ant paste, which kills ants. You should talk to my uncle about that.
Jeez.
Look at Mr. Fields spitting out the food into Lou's face. What's the matter with you? It's his birthday, bud. Lighten up. Now, you see, Bud handled that piece of slapstick very well.
Yes.
Now, look at everybody. Everybody's getting sick from the ant paste. Uh-oh. I imagine the water level, the water pressure in that building is going to be much lower in a minute.
Mm.
If you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that apartment's in Flushing. Well, this is where I used to get very sad. Oh. Now remember, it's his birthday. Look at Lou. He looks like a sad 8-year-old. Now get out of here! Now the thing is, Bud didn't mind doing things like this. Every child in America hated him at this point, you know?
Yeah.
And he didn't mind. He didn't mind. This was his burlesque responsibility to be as cruel and as violent as possible to make the comic more sympathetic. He even slams the door on him. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Oh, Bud. This is where I would lose it. I felt so sorry for him. And let's face it, he was our buddy. He was a child, just like we were, you know, at this time.
Yeah.
And I just have to say that Mr. Fields had the worst taste in wallpaper I've ever seen. Oh, I remember this. Oh. That was a great touch, by the way.
Yes.
Oh, I'm tearing up a little. I don't know about you, Jerry, but I'm tearing up again. This episode just does it to me. But that was a beautiful bit of writing because we needed that now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You needed to temper this kind of stuff. Boy. Not only get out of the apartment building, but get out of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And this used to get me too. When he'd come out of the curtain alone without Abbott. Mm-hmm. That was funny. So here he is walking along the Hal Roach studio back lot where the first season was shot. The second season was shot at the General Service Studios where they shot Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd.
Yeah.
On Sunset Boulevard. I used to pass it all the time. Now Lou's going to do a good deed and help this little old lady across the street.
Yeah, this time he is identifying as a scout, as opposed to the other times where he identifies as, you know, a campfire girl.
Yeah, a campfire girl or a Girl Scout.
Yeah.
Wait, Hal Roach had a good back lot. I'm recognizing this from A Chump at Oxford when they're cleaners. Laurel and Hardy are street cleaners.
Yep.
Same set. She didn't want us to cross the street, and she breaks the cane over his head. And, of course, Mike is right there. Mike the cop is right there. Ready to run him in.
Never a cop around when you need one unless Lou gets hit on the head.
Mike.
Yeah.
Unless it's Mike. I'm going to run you in, Costello. Oh, one last hit on the head. See, you try to be nice. Oh, this is funny. And Mike is right there.
Panhandling without a license.
Yeah, get out of this neighborhood. It's like everybody drank Bud Abbott juice this morning. Who is that? He looks a little like Hank Mann, the Senate comic. Oh, Lou. Now Lou's crossing the street. Cars are barely missing him. Ooh. You know, usually they have a stuntman doing stuff like that, really, you know, when cars get that close.
Yeah.
Oop, there's the stuntman.
There's the stuntman.
Yeah, stinky Joe Besser knocking over Lou and hitting him. I got to meet Joe Besser in 1982, I believe it was.
Mm.
And he was just as sweet as he could be. Such a nice man.
Nice.
And I have a nice picture of the two of us. And I'm wearing a curly shirt, which I thought was interesting. Oh, Lou. Look at all those old ads. Oh, ukuleles in the window. That's going to be the name of my autobiography, Ukuleles in the Window. And there's cakes, wedding cakes, birthday cakes. I wonder who runs that bakery. It must be someone who knows how to cook. Knows how to
probably
bake cakes. Lou's feeling kind of bouncy. Lou's going to take matters into his own hands. Oh. He's good at cry talk. You know, that's cry talk.
Oh, yeah.
Not everyone could do that well. There he goes. Mr. Bacigalup, of all people.
What a surprise.
What a shock. That's Joe Kirk, of course, Lou's brother-in-law. Married his sister, Marie, and was just about a year away from divorcing Marie, and that in turn divorced the entire Costello family, which means he was not in any more of their movies.
Yeah.
Or TV shows. That must have been a tough decision for Joe, you know? You give up the wife, you give up the career.
Yeah.
This is so funny. I love this section. This section takes away a lot of the sadness from the episode itself. And I think, again, this is another brilliant move. You take him out of, you know, the norm, and you put him in a very funny situation to balance the sadness. And where the hell is Bud Abbott? Again, Bud Abbott's on a lounge chair, probably on a cruise somewhere. You know? Going, maybe he's walking the streets of Paris. Who knows? Yeah. But he's not there. Boy, they're getting mad at each other. This only perpetuates the stereotype that Italians yell a lot.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know what perpetuates that stereotype?
What?
Italians who actually yell a lot. I come from a family full of them. Yes, I understand.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's funny. A friend of mine made a half-hour, like, pilot film, and he did it with AI. And it really, you know, it looks pretty good. But it's all about, you know, Italians living in Queens. And every stereotype you could possibly imagine is part of it. They don't talk to each other. They scream at each other. Every other word is the F-bomb. You know, the men hit the women and all that stuff. I didn't know anyone like that. Yeah. I'm an Italian-American. I grew up in an Italian-American family.
Yep.
We read books. We spoke properly. We were good to each other. My mother and father, my father would never abuse my mother. It's just
no.
So I watch these people, and they're like from another realm. I don't recognize them. Not part of my thing or my experience. You like a marshmallows? Marshmallows. I love it's their theme song. Every time they show the clock. Dun, 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 dun. Lou is very, very precise about the cake he wants for his birthday.
Yes.
He's going to make up for all of the disastrous party. But at least he has that picture of Mr. Fields, you know, that he could go to for strength and support. Yeah. He was just in there for 5 minutes. His initials. Now, did he go in with all this stuff in his mind that this is what he wanted?
Who knows?
Jeez. Yeah.
My main question is, did he go in there realizing that eventually he was going to have to actually pay for this cake?
But I thought I heard him say earlier that I don't have a nickel. I don't have a dime, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I love that he has his shoes on the counter. He keeps his shoes in the cake box. There it is. Look at that cake. It's beautiful. Fit for a king. Bacigalup. He's got to see it. He's got to go up there and see it.
Yep.
He's going to eat the cake there. And of course, his face ends up in it. There's your cake, Lou. I think it would have been funny if he pushes the cake, he pushes his face in the cake, and his face comes up and his initials are on his face.
Yep. Yep.
You know? See, this gives it a live feeling. Lou comes out with the towel, wiping the cake off his face.
Yeah. And he still had his shoes in his hand.
And his shoes. Yeah. And Bud is trying to make up now. See? Bud's saying, see, I'm a good guy. Lou's message. You certainly are screwy.
And there
we go. Yay. The end. An actual, seriously, one of the better episodes of that series.
Yeah.
Full of pathos and heart. Just a very nice. And it gave Bud a nice vacation. So when you watched that as a child, I feel like a freak because actually I used to bawl watching this. I used to cry like mm-hmm. a baby watching it because I felt so sorry for him. Well, how did you feel watching this as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I was that demonstrative in my emotion, but yeah, I did feel very sorry. It was we've talked about this earlier. This was one of those instances where, Bud's treatment of Lou, yeah, his meanness just went too far, in my opinion. But
yeah, I agree. He didn't have to do that. And, it's like he could have cut that in half, basically, and gotten the same effect. But he was so into it. He was so into being that, that violent, impatient, mean character. Sometimes it doesn't land well. But that's a great episode. I love that episode. And speaking of great episodes, now the centerpiece to my holiday viewing at Christmas time. And this is the Abbott and Costello Christmas show from the Colgate Comedy Hour. And the Colgate Comedy Hour was their live show. So you got to see them work in front of an audience, a live audience. And to me, it made all the difference in the world. I love the film show. And I think they do great work and they preserve those wonderful routines with a great cast of characters. But to watch them work in front of a live audience, to me, mm-hmm. it's like a little gift. I just love watching them do it.
Oh, yeah.
And in this episode, usually Lou goes through the gamut of violence. He's usually thrown through windows, through doors. He has vases of different shapes and sizes broken over his head. He even smashes the piano. I mean, he really works like crazy. And again, when I watch these shows, sometimes I have to remind myself, this is a sick man. This is a man mm-hmm. that's, he's killing himself to make us laugh. But in this one, Bud, as a Christmas present, I suppose, to Lou, is the person who gets the abuse in this mm-hmm. episode. And oh boy, does he get abuse. The interesting thing is when in that opening scene where Bud is being thrown through windows and things like that at the very mm-hmm. opening, they used it again. They saw how it worked on the Colgate Comedy Hour, and then they worked it into Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops and used the same bit. So anyway, I find that interesting that they try it out on television and then put it in a movie. So let's start this. We're going to hear Lou sing a version of White Christmas completely straight and until it falls into pandemonium. And it is pandemonium mm-hmm. with some of the greatest stuntmen in Hollywood. Okay. Yeah. So let's start with the Colgate Comedy Hour. This is going to be complete with the songs, that are part of it, the vaudeville acts that are part of it, and maybe even a few commercials. And this is colorized, folks, and I chose that on purpose because it's the holidays. Let's watch it in color. Okay?
All right.
You count it down, Mr. Jerry Boy.
OK. Counting it down, our final entry for the episode. Here we go in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Yeah, who's in it?
We'll soon find out.
Yay.
Oh, I love the Nicholas Brothers.
We love them. Boy, I caught in the mouse. Who is this Pete guy?
Good question.
Yeah. Pete Company. Isn't Pete like something you put on your lawn? You know, like Pete Moss? It's the only thing I can think of.
I think I went to school with Pete Moss.
Yes, I did. He was always on the grounds.
Yeah.
That's a good caricature. Okay. Like with every other variety or comedy show on television, it always starts with a musical number and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie Gleason did it with the June Taylor dancers. And every one of them would do something like this at the beginning of the show. And these guys, I'm not sure what their names are. I think the High Lows or something. They're in a few episodes of the Abbott and Costello Colgate shows. Boy, look at that fur she's wearing.
Mm.
I'm sure the animal is very cold right now. Oh, she's cute. Look at those dimples.
Mm.
So this young lady formed a singing act with three middle-aged guys that, you know, looked like they're about to collect their Social Security.
Mm.
And this young, really pretty girl. Well, they're no dummies. You know, it's interesting. And when Jimmy Durante was hosting, I'm not sure if it was 4-star review or Colgate Comedy Hour, but one of the chorus girls was Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh.
Yeah. Stood out like a sore thumb.
Mm.
And tomorrow is Dick Van Dyke's 100th birthday, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And today is Frank Sinatra's birthday. And there's Santa, and there's Bud, and there's Lou. In color.
Yeah,
he's gonna steal.
Yeah, on these live shows, to me, there's always that additional element of, do they actually know where they're going with the script?
You know what? I think they do. With live television, you have to rehearse. You have to. I don't care who you are. Dean Martin didn't have to because his show is taped, you know, taped live. This is just straight through, and you had to rehearse it very, very diligently. So, yeah. So they already did something they did in Buck Privates.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're doing the stuff from Noose Hangs High where Lou has to get them in jail. Bud wants them to get hit with a car so they can collect money. Bud's got a better idea. Mm-hmm. And that's Sid Fields and Dorothy Granger.
Yep.
Yeah. Dorothy's wearing this horrible hat. And Lou's picking. What did he pick out of the hat?
Grapes.
Grapes. And he's eating them. So much for that. Sid just agreed with Lou, that's all. But
camera three.
Let's talk to the camera. I mean, Lou's talking to the cameraman. Look at Bud. Yeah. You know what I love about this whole sketch?
What's that?
Is that it points a sour finger at people in general.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has something to hide. Everybody's doing something wrong or secretive, you know? That's the basis of this bit. They can't do their illegal thing because everybody else is illegal.
Yeah.
He stole it. Don't put me in jail for Christmas. Aw. Lou's crying along with him. Poor man. Bud slaps him, of course. And there's Gordon Jones. There's Mike the Cop doing a very brief bit for the boys. Look how slim he is.
Mm-hmm.
This is where Bud starts getting it.
Bam.
There he goes. Gordon Jones, wow. You know, I figured, you know, he shows up for that brief bit. Yeah. Len Strange showed up. This is funny. It looks like a Spears in Abbott. But that's what I mean about their improv skills. Lou saw that and used it. And, you know, it wasn't in rehearsal. I'm sure it wasn't in rehearsal. But people like Gordon Jones and Glenn Strange and even to a certain extent Lon Chaney Jr., they show up to do quick bits on the Colgate shows. And you know what? It made me realize these guys are just making a living. You know? They didn't care about how large the role was. It's just, you know, throw me a few bucks, I'll be happy to come in and do it.
Yeah.
And it's very easy. You know, what Gordon Jones just did, you know, I'm sure he made a nice chunk of change. And that was it. It was over. Oh, now Lou's getting his revenge on Bud. And Bud is still addlepated from being thrown through a window. Okay. Here's a guy who fell down. Wait, he looks like a monster, this guy. And there goes Bud in his second window. And that ends the scene. Lou mentions during the scene that this is only the beginning, Bud. This is just the beginning of your abuse. Okay, well, let's talk about Palmolive soaps. a brand that's still around today, Palmolive.
Yeah.
look at this guy. This guy borrowed Bud's mustache for this occasion to sell drugs. Maybe he's from Venezuela.
And you know, one of the things I do enjoy about watching these full programs like this is the commercials.
Yeah,
Just to see what it was like back then, you know.
Yeah. It's funny because when you listen to commercials on the radio from the 40s and into the 50s, you think, my God, people must have been so, naive, because these things are so corny and they're so, you know, they seem so false. And then you see things like this, you know, and it's a little better, but it's still, you know, your skin will look like porcelain if you use this 19 times a day. Look at this guy.
Of 10 doctors smoke Camels.
Exactly. And instead of cigarettes.
Yes.
When it gets around the hump, it's hard to inhale. Palmolive, chlorophyll. Now, chlorophyll was being pushed at this time. That was a big deal, chlorophyll. It changed everything from toothpaste to water.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here we are. It looks like a busy shopping place for Christmas. It's a department store. Do all women wear fur coats in the 1950s? Okay, now this is one of the more bizarre acts that we're going to see in this show. The man is Buster Shaver, and he was a vaudeville dancer for years and years. And he partnered up, that woman is Olive Brasno, and she used to work with her brother George, just like Liberace did. My brother George. Olive Brasno and George Brasno are well remembered from the Little Rascals, from Our Gang. They were the two dwarfs that in the one with the magic lamp called A Lad and a Lamp. And they wished they were children, and they shrunk down to George and Olive size.
Yeah.
And they did another one of my all-time favorites, Arbor Day, where they're mistaken for students that are cutting school, you know, and the truant officer is after them. But anyway, they were both very, very talented. At this point, George was pretty much retired, so Olive worked with Buster Shaver in this act. But I was, as I watched it, I just find it a little bizarre, this grown man dancing with this little girl, you know, and she doesn't look like a dwarf. She looks like a little girl.
Exactly. Now,
it's odd. But they were born in Old Bridge, New Jersey. And they were brought up in New Jersey, not very high, but they were brought up. Again, she spent the bulk of her career performing on stage, but occasionally the two brother and sister made feature films. Mine just froze here. There it goes. And they show up in Little Miss Broadway with Shirley Temple, The Mighty Barnum with Wallace Beery, and Sitting Pretty with Jack Haley and Jack Oakey. They're also in Charlie Chan at the Circus. And again, those two, it wasn't Aladdin a Lamp, it was Shrimps for a Day and Arbor Day, the two Art Gang comedies. She was offered a part as a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz, but she turned it down because she was making more money in vaudeville. But she did marry the dwarf actor Gus Wayne, who was one of the soldiers in Munchkin Land. And they were married for 37 years. Amazing. She passed away in Lakeland, Florida, which I played. I did stand up there. It's a very redneck town. And she died in 1998 at the age of 80. She was married for 37 years to her husband, and she outlived her husband by only 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah. It was one of those things where they were so attached, she followed along.
Mm-hmm.
She's a cutie, though. And there you go. And there's Santa Claus with the little children. I used to have something like that, the little twirly guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, like on the trapeze.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. In fact, there was one cereal, Rice Crinkles, when I was a kid, that actually had something like this, a really small version in a box, in the cereal box. Can you imagine? Not anymore, boy.
Nope.
They might choke on it. Okay, and here's the real version. This is Tom and Jerry. I don't know much about them, but they are incredible acrobats. Now, this is very typical of your live shows on television during those days. What did vaudevillians do when vaudeville was no longer viable? They did live television. They toured in circuses. They toured Europe. So there was plenty of work. It just wasn't always in this country. And, you know, vaudeville, let's face it, it made it very convenient to know what your schedule it is for the rest of the year. You've got your train schedule and you're going from one theater to the next. But these guys now had to work to find gigs. And this is one of them. Let's face it, though. Things like the Ed Sullivan Show, Milton Berle's Texaco Star Theater, the Colgate Comedy Hour, Four Star Review, these were all just vaudeville shows. Mm-hmm. Fred Allen said, vaudeville died and television is the box they buried it in.
Mm.
Leave it to Fred to wrap it up perfectly. He's also the one that said television is called a medium because nothing is well done. He was not a fan.
No.
And couldn't really find his niche. I mean, he did eventually in What's My Line, but Fred should have been like the host of like a political talk show. He would have been wonderful.
That would have intelligent suited him nicely. Opposite.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Between the witty remarks and his opinions and all that stuff, he was just a wonderful comedian. What is this guy wearing? He's got this beanie on his head. He looks like that's like the kind Spanky used to wear.
Yeah.
And he's all right. So he's the dumb one.
He's gonna jump.
Here he goes. You know, I often say that people with a musical gift are usually born with them. He's usually born with that innate, intrinsic talent. Uh-huh. Somehow it might be reincarnation. It might be whatever. I don't know. But even this, to be born with a sense of balance like this must be, incredible. And I'm sure as kids, these guys were like, walking on roofs and along ledges and, all kinds of things. But they're terrific. Look at this.
Yep.
Yeah, that's terrific. And I love that they're a duo. They're an acrobatic duo, and one is the straight man and one is the comic.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom and Jerry. Oh, here we are with Colgate Ribbon Dental Cream. I suppose when they say ribbon, it means it's multicolored. Can I say colored anymore? No, I don't think I can. Oh, my God. Elizabeth Montgomery must be in the room. Those people just popped in.
I know.
And look at this guy. Bing Crosby called. He wants his ears back.
Yeah.
And what's she making? Oh, no. She's got another baby on the way. Look at this guy. And here's the doctor. I'm sorry, sir, but your kneecaps have to come off. Colgate.
These are pretty extensively produced commercials.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Colgate was these were popular commercials, actually. Every one of these products had a catchy theme song to go with it.
Yeah.
Which is always fun. But the most famous and the one that lasted the most was for Halo, the hair thing.
Mm-hmm.
Halo, everybody, Halo. Yeah. Da, 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 da. See, even that one outlived the show. Unpleasing breath, tooth decay. And there she is, Princess Leia. And there's Bing. And there's Mom, who was an advisor to Barbara Billingsley. Pure white safe Colgates will not stain or discolor. Okay, are you ready? Because this routine it's hilarious. This is where Bud, he deserves an award here. And all he does is sleep, really, through the routine.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because it is just absolutely. When I first saw this, Jerry, I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Oh,
It's hilarious. All right. Now, this is fascinating. I'm going to tell this to our viewers. Right now, they're not communicating. Lou is trying to get Bud to say something about their job that they just acquired. Bud is not picking up the cue, and he's ignoring him. He keeps telling him, never mind, never mind. Lou wants to set up the next scene. Now, what he's saying is he's trying to set up the fact that Bud got them executive positions, and that sets up the fact that they're only delivery men in the next scene.
Yeah.
And Bud did not pick it up. So anyway, now they're on to the next thing, and Lou does not give up. He's still trying to get that across. See? Now, this is something like the bit they did with the massage, where Bud lays down for a massage, and of course the radio switches, and instead it's a radio show about painting cars. So Lou has to paint Bud while Bud sleeps. And in this one, Bud falls asleep again, and Lou makes the mistake of listening to the wrong instructions. He's supposed to be giving a head massage. And Lou's falling asleep. You can see Bud's bald spot. Lou actually, his hair was thinning by this point. And there are some, even in the films, sometimes when you see the top of his head, you could see how thin his hair is. And he colored it in, you know, with black. Yeah. But his brother, Pat, was kind of, had really receding hairline. And so did his dad. So Lou was lucky to have those strands up there because it looks like a full head of hair. What is this, the eggs? Oh, no, this is the lotion.
The hair tonic, yes.
Mm-hmm. He's a tonic comic. I'm sure Lou had a great time doing this. Good, bud. This is Bud come up its day. Look at his hair. You can see Bud did a little bit of a comb over. Okay. The eggs. I love the way he uses Bud's hair to try to keep the eggs from falling. He tries to shape Bud's hair into like a cup. Oh, there go the eggs. Boom. This is so funny. There we go. What does he have, a fly swatter?
Yeah.
It didn't work. He's setting it up now. Now he's just going to throw them on his head. He's not having much luck with the eggs. Look at him. He's cracking up.
Cracking himself up, yeah.
You got to hand it to Bud, though. I'd be laughing. He's really under control.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's massaging the head. So what happened was now it is turned, without Lou knowing it, to a recipe for a turkey dinner. And he's putting all of the ingredients on Bud's head. What are those? The onions and stuff?
Yeah, celery and onions. Yeah.
Celery and onions. Oh my God, Bud. Bud deserves an Emmy just for this.
Yeah.
Look at him. Okay. What's next?
Can of mushrooms.
Can of mushrooms.
Or you can cut them.
Yeah, or not. Bam! He hits it off of Bud's head. So no mushrooms. And I agree. Okay. Now that's real laughter.
Oh yeah.
That's not about it. Okay. Here's the turkey, an unusually large one.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does with this turkey is unbelievable. Even Lou has to step in front of Bud to get a look at it. That's how unbelievable it is.
Yes.
And inside the dead turkey, for some reason, is a baby chick, a baby chicken coming out of a dead turkey. Only in the world of Abbott and Costello, my friends, can a live chick live in a dead turk.
Mm-hmm.
I like how careful Lou is. He puts it in a little pan and hands it off to a stagehand. Because it's a baby. The turkey almost knocked him out as he tried to pick it up. Now, this is just amazing what he does. There he is, opening up the belly of the beast. And stuff the noodle into the turkey. Mm-hmm. And of course, the noodle being Bud's head. And they use a turkey complete with the head attached, the neck attached, mm-hmm. everything, the legs. And he's putting it on Bud's head with the turkey's butt looking right at us. And Lou has to see it. He has to go in front to see it. Look at the butt. Look at the turkey's butt. He's like Butt Abbott.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is hilarious. So now he's got to put the turkey in the oven, which is attached to Butt Abbott. And Bud's still asleep. You can see the oven has been preheated. Bud is all the way in, almost. Now, what they're doing here is Bud is in the oven. The makeup men are putting a bald wig on him because the gag is the oven has burned his hair off. But it's taking longer than usual, and Lou has to ad-lib, and he even starts drumming a little bit here just to kill time while they're putting this bald cap on Bud. See? I wonder if he did that at home a lot with the spoons. You say, hurry up, Bud, hurry up. I'm running out of things to do. All right, here he comes. And he's got the towel around his head. See, you just saw he was bald. This was not done very well.
Mm-hmm.
But he looks great. He's only got the fringe hair around his head. Now he's seeing himself for the first time. Lou runs away, out the door. Bud opens it and grabs him. And puts him in the oven. But the door opens, and that's not Lou. The real Lou comes out, and Bud has to finish the scene by throwing Lou through the door, which is how they ended a lot of their sketches.
Oh, yeah.
Another commercial for Giant Size Fab. And I think, isn't Fab still around? Isn't that still a detergent?
I think so.
I think it is. Boy, Palmolive really has sustained a presence, you know, in American life. It's amazing. Okay, there's the typical mom wearing a dress to clean the house. She looks a little like Betty White, doesn't she?
She does.
Yeah, she has that Betty White privilege.
And a typical son sitting buck naked in the bathtub.
Yeah, typical, you know. I think all women in dresses doing housework have a naked boy in the bathtub, but they usually get arrested.
Yeah.
At that point. So livelier white, you know, as opposed to stoic white.
Yes.
You know, immobile white. And look at Fab is placed beautifully right up there where you can see it. And this kid is like, go ahead.
He's going to wash his hands in the washer water? I mean, what?
Just wait until he puts them through the ringer.
We just saw him in the tub. What does he have to wash his hands now for?
That's the magic of these commercials. They're just, you know, they leave you wondering, how do they do that? And look, everybody bought Fab. And whiter washes without bleaching. That's the thing. And there's Margaret Whiting. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Margaret Whiting, because she was a major star.
Yes.
Born Margaret Eleanor Whiting in 1924, same year my dad was born. She gained popularity in the 40s and 50s, mostly. She was born in Detroit. The family moved to Los Angeles in 1929 when she was five. Her father, Richard Whiting, was a very, very famous and popular songwriter. He was responsible for Hooray for Hollywood, Ain't We Got Fun, In the Morning, In the Evening, Ain't We Got Fun, On the Good Ship, Lollipop, that one. Also, her sister, Barbara Whiting, was an actress and a singer, and she was in a few movies, movies like Junior Miss and Beware My Lovely. Her aunt, Margaret Young, was a singer and a popular recording artist in the 1920s. Very musical family. Her singing ability was noticed by her aunt, Margaret, and at seven, she sang for Johnny Mercer, who was writing songs with her father, Richard Whiting, and they wrote together the song, You're Much Too Marvelous for Words. Great songs, just great songs. In 1942, Johnny Mercer created Capitol Records, and Margaret Whiting was one of the first people he signed for a long-term contract. Her first records were with bands. She was just like a singer with the bands. But her big hit was Moonlight in Vermont, which I think is still the only popular song without one rhyme in it. And she recorded that with Billy Butterfield's orchestra, the great trumpet player, Billy Butterfield. It sold over 1 million copies. She also did That Old Black Magic with Freddie Slack and his orchestra, and It Might As Well Be Spring with Paul Weston and his orchestra. In 1945, she went solo and had a few hits, A Tree in the Meadow in 1948, and she did a duet with a country music star, Jimmy Wakely. They did a song called Slippin' Around, and that was another number one hit in 1949. It sold almost 2 million copies, and she was titled the Queen of the Jukeboxes. Anyway, she continued to record for Capitol, ended up recording at different companies, and her sister and she did the summer replacement series, I think for two or three seasons, for I Love Lucy in a sitcom called Those Whiting Girls. That was from 55 to 57. She did every variety show in the world, and she was married four times. Mm-hmm. One of her husbands was the guy who started Panavision, the cameras that everybody used.
Yeah.
And her last husband, was Jack Wrangler, real name John Stillman. He was a 1970s and 80s gay pornography star. She married him in 1994. She was 70. He was 48.
Whoa.
He died of emphysema in 2009, and she followed in 2011 at the age of 86. And she died at the Lillian Booth Actors Home in Inglewood, New Jersey, which is a place, when I think about it, I could end up there. It's for actors' equity, union members who, you know, are alone or whatever. So yeah. It's very possible I might end up there. Yeah. Now, here we have Syd Fields again, who we love. And the woman is Dorothy Granger. Now, if you're a classic comedy fan, you know Dorothy Granger. She was pretty much one of the queens of the two-reeler, the comedy slapstick two-reeler. That was her niche.
Mm-hmm.
She was born Dorothy Carolyn Granger in 1911. She was born in New London, Ohio. And the family move to Silver Beach, a summer resort towards Houston, near Houston, where she won a beauty contest at the age of 13. She was very, she developed very early on. Let's put it that way. She was a very Zoftic or buxom woman. Very sexy when she was a young lady. Very, very, very pretty. So anyway, in 1930, her father moved the family to Los Angeles and took her to the Hal Roach Studios. And she was just there in time to audition for a new series called The Boyfriends. Now, the Boyfriend series was George Stevens, the great film director. This was his big project at the Hal Roach Studios. And it comprised of, whatchamacallit, it comprised of Davy Sharp, the great stuntman, and also Grady Sutton, the great comic actor. Well, fan my brow. That's what he would say. That was his catchphrase. And, you know, a few others, Mary Corman and Gertie Messenger. So anyway, it was a successful series. They worked for a couple of seasons, but she also worked for Max Sennett Studios, Educational, Columbia, RKO. She was in Hogwild with Laurel and Hardy. The Dentist, very memorable with W.C. Fields. She was that pretty woman that kept bending down in front of him. She made Punch Drunks and Termites of 1938 with the Stooges. She appeared with Andy Clyde, Charlie Chase, Edgar Kennedy, Harry Langdon, Gus Schilling, and Richard Lane, and Joe Derrida. But her most famous was as the sarcastic and suspicious wife of Leon Errol in his long-running series. Yeah, at RKO. She was always the wife. Very, very good. She also made some features. She appeared in about 100 feature films in small roles, usually unbilled. She was in Frisco Jenny with Ruth Chatterton, Kentucky Colonels with Wheeler and Woolsey and Spanky McFarlane, Dick Tracy versus Cue Ball, one of my favorites, Diamond Jim with Edward Arnold, and Showboat, James Whale's production of Showboat with Alan Jones and Irene Dunne. She did the Abbott and Costello Show. She did the Colgate Show. She was on I, Mary Joan, Father Knows Best, Topper, Death Valley Days, Wells Fargo. Her last television performance was a live show called Face the Facts in 1961. She left show business in 1963. She called it an ulcer factory. That's interesting, an ulcer factory. And made her last public appearance in 1993. For the Screen Actors Guild's 60th anniversary celebration, because she was an honored guest, because she was one of SAG's first members back in the early 30s.
Oh.
And in her later years, she helped her husband run an upholstery shop in Los Angeles, which is good because she looked like she was stuffed pretty well. That was terrible, misogynistic, and so horrible. Maybe I'll say it again later. She died of cancer. In 1995 at the age of 83 in Los Angeles, California. But she was terrific. Now, here they are doing the famous fireplace goodbye scene. This is something that they used to do in burlesque. Look at Bud. Bud looks depressed. This, I have to say that while we're watching this, this was my least favorite scene in the show, of Abbott and Costello's bits in this show. I just thought it was a little too repetitive, them moving all the appliances in and then having to move them out and then having to move them in again. It just, to me, it got a little tiresome. But this ending is fun.
Yeah, it's just a variation on the pack-unpack and not as well done.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. But it does give a nice roles to Sid and Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
In the show. So everybody's saying goodbye to the old fireplace. And Lou can't quite understand it. But of course, Bud joins right in.
Yep.
Anything to make Lou feel out of it. And he says goodbye to the fireplace. And this is where Lou gives his Christmas message to the crew and everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost feels like this should be the end of this episode.
Yeah, but you know, the last scene is so choreographed and so crazy that I see why they're doing it now. And how sweet that they're doing it at all, you know?
Well, yes, I agree.
And they did. They made a fortune this year. He ad-libbed. You see, he was a wonderful improviser.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's making this all up. Of course, the hand comes out and shakes his hand. Aww. And Lou is thrown into the Christmas tree. Another commercial. Smoother, more comfortable shaves. Palmolive brushless shaving cream. And now here's animation. Three barbers singing their Palmolive brushless shaving cream song.
And I'm sorry, but I always thought it was a barbershop quartet. Maybe they couldn't afford a fourth animated barber. I don't know.
You know, I didn't really put that together. But you're right. It should have been a barbershop quartet. Even there, there's three. Well, three out of four.
Yes.
More comfortable. Yes. And so delicious.
Yeah.
There's the fourth guy. He's in the frame.
There we go.
No. Do people still wear aftershave? I don't know anyone that wears aftershave.
That's an excellent question. I mean, body spray seems to have taken the place of aftershave.
You're probably right. You know, because in our generation, I know my father always had, you know, like Aqua Velva or Old Spice or something like that. But there was always aftershave. But I don't know anyone that uses it now.
No.
And okay, just, here we go, guys.
Just think, without aftershave, we wouldn't have had those great moments from Home Alone, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. It did smell good. I remember, you know, I did associate my dad with, you know, the smell of Aqua Velva and Old Spice.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Now, these are the Nicholas brothers,
often
thought of as the greatest tap dancers of all time. Yep. Seriously, all time.
Yep.
The guy on the right is Fayard, and he was a friend of mine. I'm very proud to say that towards the end of his life, Fayard and I became friends. And I want to tell you a little bit about that. First, let me tell you about their history. Fayard Antonio Nicholas was born in 1914 in Mobile, Alabama. And Harold, his younger brother, by 7 years, was born in 1921 in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They were, their parents were college educated, both musicians, father a drummer, the mother a piano player, and they worked in the orchestra when the family moved to Philadelphia, where the boys grew up. They worked at the local theater. I think it was called The Standard. And it was a African-American vaudeville theater. And their parents were a part of it. That meant that young Fayard, by the time he was 3 years old, used to sit in the front row and watch all the acts over and over and over again. And by watching the dancers, he was inspired to try it himself as a child. And he learned, he taught himself. What he's doing right now, he taught himself to do. Then he taught his sister, Dorothy, and he taught Harold how to dance. And look at them. His biggest thing was his father gave him this advice, use your arms. You have to use the upper part of your body, you know, or else it's kind of boring. And Fayard, look at his arms. Look at his hand work. Look at him. It's just as eloquent as their dancing, their foot dancing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just as choreographed. Now, whatchamacallit, they were, by the time Fayard was 18 and Harold was 11, they were headlining at the Cotton Club in Harlem. And they were the only act allowed to fraternize with the white customers. So they were always at people's tables and, you know, hanging around and working with Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway and all the greats, Fats Waller. They were just amazing. Eventually, Samuel Goldwyn asked them to come to Hollywood, and they did a bit with Eddie Cantor and Kid with Millions. And that was the first of their motion pictures. They made some short subjects for Warner Brothers, and those are a delight. You can see those on YouTube. I think one is called the All Black Radio Network. Another one is called Pie Pie Blackbird. And that's my favorite. That's the one with U.B. Blake and Ethel Waters. But anyway, Pie Pie Blackbird is, yeah, that's the one with U.B. Blake. They did on Broadway. Their first Broadway show was The Ziegfeld Follies of 1936. And then Rodgers and Hart hired them for Babes in Arms, where they made a huge hit. And they were choreographed by George Balanchine, the great ballet choreographer, who wow. thought they were just amazing. They ended up going to Europe where, you know, standards were different as far as racism, and they were treated as huge stars all over Europe and England. They performed for King George the Sixth, and they made movies, you know, at 20th Century Fox. And these movies, they only did guest appearances. They came on, they did a dance number, and then they were gone. And that was because it was so easy to cut those numbers out in the southern states, which is so sad when you think about it. And these people were missing the greatest dancers. My God. And their dance in a movie called Stormy Weather with Cab Calloway, they do Jump and Jive. Fred Astaire considered it the greatest dance number ever put on film. And that's the one where they go down the stairs and they land and splits over and over and over again. And the legend is that Nick Castle, the choreographer, told them not to rehearse it and to just do it in one take. And that's what they did. Wow. And Harold was so happy because they didn't have to do it again and again and again. So you're seeing their first take. Okay. So Harold was the more contentious of the two. He was very sensitive to the racism and all that. And I don't blame him. He was an angry young man. Fayard, you know, he ended up choreographing on Broadway. He won a Tony for his choreography. I held that Tony in my hands. And here's a very interesting thing. I know I'm talking over Lou's bit here, but I have a history with Fayard Nicholas. And he was married to a woman by the name of Catherine Hopkins at the end. And Catherine Hopkins had a very interesting history. She was first married to Herbie Weir of the Weir Brothers. And of course, he was much older and part of a brother act. So when Herbie died, she married Fayard Nicholas of the Nicholas Brothers. And he was much older than she, about by 25 years or so. And the two of them shared a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, not very luxurious. They didn't have money. And I spent, you know, Fayard's birthday there, Thanksgiving once. And I was the last person to sing Chattanooga Choo Choo with him. And we watched these numbers together. And he told me, he commented on them as we watched. It was wonderful. He passed away in 2006, and that was a very sad day. But Catherine Hopkins' father was Bob Hopkins, and she didn't know her father at all. He died when she was a baby, and there was a big picture of her father over the dinner table. And I looked, and I said, oh, my God, that's the guy from the Abbott and Costello show. Bob Hopkins played the host of Hold That Cuckoo, the game show that Lou goes on, among other things. He's in Crashing Las Vegas with Leo Gorcey and the Bowery Boys. He just got around towards the late 50s. So I got to show her these things for the first time. She was seeing her father. It was really neat.
Wow.
And after Fayard died, they owed so much money. And me and my friend Rusty Frank, we raised money to help them, to help her. And she died shortly afterwards of cancer. It was terrible. Mm. Anyway, here's Lou. He just sang White Christmas very nicely, I should say. Even yes. Spoke a little of it. Now he's doing this is the dance act he learned in burlesque. And this is the one he would go to when he needed to do a dance. Here we go. The orchestra's ready. That's Al Goodman's orchestra. I always thought Al Goodman was Benny Goodman's brother, but he wasn't. It was that was Harry Goodman who played the bass. But Al Goodman was born in the Ukraine. Now that's Harvey Perry, one of the great stuntmen of all time. He actually doubled for Harold Lloyd climbing the building in Safety Last.
Wow.
Yeah, these are all Hollywood stuntmen. And Harvey's one of the best of all time. I'm just wondering, is Davy Sharp part of this? I don't know if I recognize him. But anyway, now all hell breaks loose. They're breaking violins over their heads, and Lou's still trying to, he's still trying to conduct.
Yeah. I got to say, the question that ran through my mind was, I wonder what the violin budget was for this number here.
Well, you knew it was all like, you know, what's that wood?
Yeah, the balsa wood. Yeah.
The balsa wood, you know, probably didn't feel a thing.
Yeah, but still, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, oh yeah, even the drum and everything else. This is like the Spike Jonze show. He's got the drum around him, his pants are falling down. And now Bud's with Al Goodman with the gun, and it goes off and it releases maybe the largest chandelier I've ever seen, which lands right on Lou. And this is the goodbye.
Yep.
That was wonderful. When I first saw this, I was so impressed by, number one, the fact that he did White Christmas straight through, and all the stunt work from the orchestra, from the stuntmen in the orchestra. It was just wild. And there's Buddy Boy in his tuxedo, and Lou looking like he did all the work,
yes.
which he did.
Yes.
Actually, Bud really went above and beyond in this one. And he looks great in a tux.
Mm-hmm.
Merry Christmas, you guys. Thanks for the entertainment. And now I guess I don't have to watch it for Christmas. I already did.
Oh, there you go.
Colgate cleans your breath and paints your car.
Yeah.
Palm Olive brushless shaving cream. You won't find any brush in this tube. Fab, the detergent that makes your clothes so white you can't see them. And Palmolive chlorophyll green soap, so delicious with soup. The Abbott and Costello Show, written by John Grant. There we go.
Yep.
And there's Al Goodman from the Ukraine. Louis Dupron, who was a friend of my friend, Rusty Frank. She took lessons from him, tap dancing lessons. Yeah. Furs by Teitelbaum. For those of you who love Spike Jonze. Sam Fuller. For some reason, I thought it was the famous film director, Sam Fuller, but it wasn't. It's someone else. And Ed Sobel was the director. He also worked on the Lawrence Welk Show, the George Gobel Show, Spike Jones. And that reminds me, I want to remind everyone of my favorite Abbott and Costello Christmas story. I might have told this before, but I think it bears repeating. Lou considered Christmas to be his personal holiday. He just loved everything about it. He was like a six-year-old. And every year he had the Universal tech people come over and decorate his house. And it was a showcase. It was a showplace, I should say. It was one of those places where traffic was all the way down, you know, Ventura Boulevard, all the way down, just to see this house. There were lights. There were mechanical reindeer and Santa Claus on the roof, you know, yelling ho, ho, ho. There were cartoons on a loop being shown on the front lawn. I mean, you name it, he had it. In fact, one year he was late at the studio and they pulled the switch to light the house up before he got there. He was like a child. He didn't speak for the rest of the night. He was so upset that he missed it. So he was like that. But anyway, they lived across the street from the comedian George Gobel, who had a very popular television show at the time. Mm-hmm. And across the street, he didn't have any Christmas decorations at all. He had one light bulb on his mailbox, and under the light bulb was a note that read, "See our display across the street." And I just think that is brilliant. Old Lonesome George got the last laugh. Yes. But anyway, we celebrated Christmas with the boys, and I hope everybody out there enjoyed watching this stuff with us and our commentary. And we hope you enjoyed us going through your letters and your nice words and your questions. And I want to thank my writing partner, Matthew Conium, for adding his 2 cents mm-hmm. to the game. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. Jerry, I just want to tell you, it's been great as usual. And I want to wish you the happiest holiday you've ever had.
And back at you, my friend.
Thank you.
And all as Christmassy as it can get in Florida. You know, I'm a New Englander and I'm not a big fan of snow, but mm-hmm. Christmas is cold and snowy.
Yes. And so is my Aunt Doris.
Oh, is she?
But other than that, I'm just saying it's getting a little cooler here in Florida as you know, you get to December and January and February, but it's, you know, cool here is like 65 degrees, 60 right. degrees, you know, maybe in the 50s. So I accept that gratefully, you know, because I'm a cold fan. Winter mm-hmm. is my favorite time of year. I love snow. I love cold weather. Yeah. So people think I'm nuts. But anyway, I wish you all the best, Jerry. Enjoy all of that. Enjoy the tour. You're very blessed right now. And it's wonderful that you are.
Thank you.
I want to congratulate my friend Greg Airbar for his appearance on Turner Classics with his book about Hanna-Barbera and showing those movies for 2 weeks. He was on 2 Wednesdays in a row introducing movies, and he did a great job. So wonderful, Greg. Nice job. All right. So in the meantime, Jerry, again, Merry, Merry Christmas. And to all of you out there, I want to wish you a very, very happy and most of all, healthy holiday season. I want to wish those who celebrate a Merry Christmas. Somebody asked me if I celebrate Ramadan. I usually stay there in those hotels when I can. And, you know, if you celebrate that, fine. If you celebrate Hanukkah, a happy Hanukkah. And I think I'm leaving one out that is celebrated in this country, but I can't think of it right now. So let's just make a blanket Merry Christmas, everybody. All the best. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you for our New Year's show coming up next in episode 43. Merry Christmas, everybody.